From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, vampires, witches, and sadomasochists, we talk with Anne Rice, author of the best-selling Vampire Chronicles, and she's written a series of pornographic novels under a pseudonym. Also on this Halloween, the horror fiction of H.P. Lovecraft. Writer Robert Peterson tells us about a time when basketball was a slow-moving, low-scoring game played by men of average height. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album from Todd Machover, a composer who mixes classical styles with modern computer technology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush escalated the administration's anti-Iraq rhetoric today, but at the same time said there was no timetable yet for a military strike. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
Just a day after President Bush was told by congressional leaders that they wanted the administration to be patient and give economic sanctions a chance, the president today expressed impatience with those measures because they hadn't dislodged Iraq from Kuwait. He also said that he was worried by reports that Americans held in Iraq were being mistreated and is angry that the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait City was still being blockaded.
Our people inside are being starved by a brutal dictator. And do you think I'm concerned about it? You're darn right I am. And what I'm going to do about it, let's just wait and see. Because I have had it with that kind of treatment of Americans.
While some suggest that the escalation of rhetoric is a way to try and show Saddam Hussein that the U.S. means business, others say that the tough talk coming just a week or so before a congressional election is pure politics. Although today, President Bush vehemently denied political motives. I'm Michael Richards at the White House.
The heightened rhetoric in Washington was reflected around the world, where there are growing signs of frustration with Iraq's apparent intransigence. NPR's Ann Garrels has this roundup.
Given Saddam Hussein's reluctance to accept the judgment of world opinion, the commander of British forces in the Gulf warned today an attack against Iraq is increasingly likely. Air Chief Marshal Sir Paddy Hines said joint teams from the Royal Air Force, Navy, and Army are developing plans for military strikes. In Egypt, President Hosni Mubarak said he hoped our brothers in Iraq will understand well the situation is very dangerous and could explode at any moment. Mubarak scoffed at Soviet President Gorbachev's call for a peaceful Arab solution to the Gulf. He said previous Arab summits called to deal with the crisis achieved nothing but insults. At the same time Gorbachev made that proposal earlier this week, he said a military solution was unacceptable. Today, his chief envoy to the Gulf was quoted as saying Moscow, in fact, would not oppose force to get Iraq out of Kuwait, though he said the Soviets would not be part of it. I'm Ann Garrels reporting.
British defense officials said today that Iraqi forces have dug into a 150-mile-long defensive line across Kuwait and that it would be very difficult for Allied aircraft to dislodge them. The officials gave a briefing in London on condition that they not be identified. They described Iraq's front in Kuwait as an obstacle belt of mines, wire fences, and tank traps. Iraq's own tanks are said to be so well dug into the desert that it would be hard for aircraft to locate them. The British officials said that the multinational force is expected to have a formidable array of air power in the region by mid-November, but would still be outnumbered by Iraqi forces on the ground. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 6 points today to close at 2,442.33. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Halloween, it's common to indulge yourself in thinking about the supernatural. My guest, Anne Rice, thinks about the supernatural most of the year. She wrote contemporary vampire stories in her best-selling Vampire Chronicles. The vampire Lestat was about one of the undead who had such dark charisma he became a rock star. Rice turns to witchcraft in her new novel, The Witching Hour. If this isn't enough to convince you that she leads a pretty wild fantasy life, I should tell you she's also written contemporary erotic fiction under the pen name Anne Rampling, and a series of pornographic novels under the name A.N. Roquelar. Her new novel, The Witching Hour, is about a neurosurgeon who discovers she's descended from a long line of witches. I wanted to know why Rice turned to the subject of witches.
All I can say is an idea for a book came into my mind. It took over. the book began to take shape. It was about this spirit lasher, this discarnate entity who had become the familiar and the lover of these witches. And the whole thing simply began to take on its own life. It wasn't a conscious decision. You know, it wasn't saying, I'd like to branch out. I mean, that's true. I would. And I do feel that way, and I want to write all kinds of supernatural novels. I want to write a great haunting novel. I want to write a novel in the Frankenstein tradition, that type of thing. But the decisions really aren't made in that logical or rational way.
Can you describe a little bit what the witches are like in your book? What makes them witches? What special powers they have?
In my book, witches are people who can attract and manipulate unseen forces. They can do things to matter. They can make things happen that other people can't make happen. They have a sort of psychic energy. And they particularly can draw these discarnate spirits and cause these spirits to fall in love with them and do what they want.
And can these powers be used for good and evil?
Oh, absolutely. Just as any human being can use his or her powers for good or evil.
Vampires exist in horror fiction and in movies, but there are a lot of people today who think of themselves as practicing witches. It's not only part of the occult, but there's even a branch of feminist paganism that feels very connected to witchcraft. Do you have any connection to that or any interest in it?
No, I really don't. What interested me in the book were these women as outcasts. They have unusual powers. They have a great deal of imagination. They know things other people don't know. That's probably true today of the women who are interested in Wicca or witchcraft now. For me, what's more interesting is the fact that it's a metaphor for everyone's exceptional powers. I mean, you can read The Witching Hour as being about women with great imagination or great creative power. You can read it as being about women with great sexual drives that perhaps set them apart from the other women around them. The great thing about supernatural fiction is that all those metaphors are there. If you give your whole heart to it as a writer, it's an endless well of meaning, really.
Did you ever have an experience that you could only attribute to the supernatural that was either like mystical or psychic?
No, I've actually had none. But I'll tell you, I'm very afraid of the dark. I'm very afraid of being alone. I've felt all my life that there's something there, and I think I shut it out. I think I consciously shut it out because the evidence, the written scholarly evidence for apparitions, for ghosts, for something out there that we can't explain is really rather overwhelming, and I think it scares me.
So you believe that that's a possibility?
Oh, definitely. I really do. I'm not close-minded on any of that. The more I read in the occult, the more I'm fascinated by what ordinary people have experienced with mediums, communicating with the dead, in their near-death experiences. We have a lot of books on that today. In past life, regression, things like this. I'm fascinated. I'm open-minded.
Now, early in your life, I think you were part of the Catholic Church, and I think your mother used to be fairly religious. Is there any connection to the imagery of the church and the imagery of vampire and witches as you use them in your books?
Oh, I think so. I really do. The spiritual realm is an absolute reality to anyone who's a Catholic. You grow up believing that what's invisible and spiritual is infinitely more important than what's material and real around you. And though I lost my faith in God very early and my faith in the church very early, there remained a sort of spiritual urgency, a kind of religious approach, as it were, to writing and to seeking answers about life. And it was only when I started to write Interview with a Vampire, you know, a book about a vampire from his point of view, that I was able to talk about all that, about good and evil, about grief over the loss of faith, that kind of thing. I use that supernatural character to speak in those spiritual terms, and it's not surprising to me that an ex-Catholic would do that, you know. I mean, when you grow up believing in saints, and you grow up talking to those saints as though they're your friends, and you know, saying your prayers to the Blessed Virgin Mary and to God, you were used to faith. You were used to caring about these sort of cosmic questions, and it all fits together in some way.
Would you want to live the eternal life of the vampire? Everybody wants a long life, but the story of the vampire is one of like eternal life, but there's a terrible trade-off for it. It's a it's a kind of miserable life, and you need to live off the blood of others to keep up that life. Of course, the life is less miserable for your vampires than for for a lot of the classic vampires.
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about that, and I think if a vampire were to come to me and say, I can make you immortal, we do exist, I think I might find the offer irresistible. What about you? I mean, do you think you would turn it down? I say, I don't think many people really would have the strength to turn it down.
I'd want to know what the life was going to be like. No, seriously. Like, what were the rules going to be? What would I be allowed to do? Would I have to sleep in a coffin during the day? And would I, you know, would the things that I enjoy now still be enjoyable? Would there be anything to make life worth living?
I still think, even if all the answers to that were pretty bad, I don't know. The fear of death is pretty profound.
Do you worry about that a lot, death?
No, not really.
I think people worry more, some people worry more about the death of the people they love than they do about their own death.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's definitely true. You know, we don't experience our own death, probably. I don't know. Who knows?
You've broken some of the vampire rules in your vampire books by allowing them to enjoy life more, to be out in non-vampire hours. And
Well, I took the conventions that were of interest to me. I mean, the sun can destroy my vampires or hurt them very badly. They don't shy away from garlic or crucifixes. They don't have any clear indication of the existence of God or absolute good and evil. They exist in a sort of existential world the way we do. They have our doubts. But that's what interested me about the myth. And I think everybody who's written about vampires has done pretty much the same thing. Bram Stoker took what he thought was of interest, Sheridan Le Fanu before him. We've all done that. We've all, I think, seen the power of that metaphorical character, that mythic character, and how wonderful it is to work with that fictionally. And then we adjust the rest according to some sort of inner logic for the book.
You know, when I read Bram Stoker's Dracula, I really started thinking that the story had a lot to do with fear of syphilis.
Could have.
Yeah.
Could
and have. I'm wondering how AIDS is affecting your vampires, and I ask that because I know you're continuing the vampire series.
Well, there's no logical or direct connection. I think there is a darkening of my work in that's inevitable because I have lost some of my friends to AIDS. And so as you grow older and you suffer those losses and you see that kind of tragedy, your work changes. It has to change. The music becomes a little sadder. There's more, perhaps a greater sense of tragedy. I think The Witching Hour is the darkest book I've ever written, really, and the least optimistic. And I'm sure that is directly related to AIDS.
What were the vampire books and movies or related occult books and movies, horror movies, et cetera, that got you very interested in that sensibility?
Well, to tell you the truth, I wasn't all that interested, really. You know, before I wrote an Interview with the Vampire, I can't say that I went out of my way to watch a lot, you know, of horror movies. I loved them, and they were, I loved them as much as many people did, but they weren't a full-time obsession. But the movie I saw as a child that I never forgot was Dracula's Daughter. It was a wonderful 1930s black and white film, very subtle, very elegant, very, very seductive film about Dracula's daughter and how she deplored being a vampire and tried to escape the curse. The Bride of Frankenstein is a movie that I think is an absolute classic, one of the greatest horror movies ever made, a wonderful movie. You could watch it 15 times and it would always give you something new. And yet it's a B-movie, probably. Angel Heart is an absolutely fabulous modern horror movie that I respect deeply. But I'll tell you, I recently remembered that the first movie I ever saw as a child was Olivier's Hamlet. And the only scene I remember from it is the ghost scene. So maybe that imprinted itself on my little girl mind. I don't know. But then, of course, millions of other people saw that movie and they didn't grow up to write Interview with the Vampire. I don't know.
Right. Your books have a lot of sexual encounters in them. And in fact, you write pornography as well as writing your novels. How did you start writing pornography. And I think we could call it pornography. I mean, you'd call it pornography,
right? Oh, sure.
Right? Yeah, I mean, we don't have to be pretend that it's not that.
No, you don't have to call it erotica for me. You know, that's a prettier word, maybe, but it's pornography. Actually, I don't write it anymore. I wrote 3 books of it.
Oh, you stopped.
Under the pen name A.N. Rokalar, and those books are being very, very well received now. But it's been some time since I wrote them, and I really accomplished there what I wanted to accomplish. I don't think I'll be doing any more. But what I did basically was write the erotica or pornography that I could never find in the bookstore. What I consider a much more playful, enjoyable, fantastical version of a sexual fantasy, a kind of theme park of S&M, so to speak. Because I think most pornography that's published is just hack work, and it's filled with a lot of gratuitous violence that people really don't want. I mean, as long as people who make pornography, whether it's films or books, as long as they have no respect for the audience and they don't really care what the audience wants, they won't really know, and there won't be anything sensitive or fine in it. And I think it's a very worthwhile genre. There's no reason for there not to be very, very fine pornography.
Does it bother you when people try to make the distinction between erotica and pornography and say, well, erotica is acceptable, but pornography is filthy and we don't like that?
I think I'm much more interested in the idea that sex is really good, that we in the 20th century have achieved something wonderful in divorcing sex from superstition and in approaching it from a psychological and ethical point of view. And I'm much more interested in the idea that pornography does not have to have redeeming social merit. Those kind of things interest me more than distinctions, like what is erotica or what is pornography. I wish more authors would write pornography. I wish the genre wasn't so neglected. And I think people want it. As I said, my pornography today is getting very, very good response, especially from women. They seem to enjoy it very much and to be glad somebody wrote it. So it's been altogether, for me, a very, very positive experience.
My guest is novelist Anne Rice. Her new book is called The Witching Hour. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Anne Rice. Her new book is called The Witching Hour. Even in your novels, there's an element of domination and submission. I mean, in The Witching Hour, in the first sexual encounter, there's a line about her tender, bruisable flesh excited him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of all pornography, S&M is the pornography that people consider to be the most sick. You know, except for very violent pornography, though. There's a degree of violence, even in the most tame S&M. Were you afraid of either writing or having those kinds of fantasies, afraid that it was... That it meant that there was something wrong with you?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I think the human mind is a marvelous thing. And the thing about sadomasochism, and here I'm speaking about mild games, really, of dominance and submission between consenting people. The thing about it is that many, many millions of people have those fantasies, and they transcend sex. Men have them as well as women. Men love to imagine that they are in a voluptuous bondage and being forced to do things by beautiful women, just as women imagine that they're being overcome by a handsome pirate or a Yankee officer or whatever. People the world over enjoy that sort of thing. Not everyone, obviously. And for those who don't have those fantasies can be completely opaque. They just don't get it. They don't know what the rest of us are talking about, and that's fine. I mean, the great thing about sex is there is such a variety of types of fantasy. But the S&M fantasy is a very popular thing, and I don't think people should be frightened by having it. I think it's much more interesting to ask ourselves why. You know, why do we want that little vacation from responsibility? And I can say this, after, you know, writing this material and talking to people who have responded for years, the majority of the people who respond to this are the masochists. They are not sadists. You know, they're not the genuine sadist who delights in dominating another person is a very rare thing, really. And We're talking about something completely apart from crime or violence or anything that doesn't involve consent. It's a fascinating thing that the human mind does this. And I like the idea of knowing more about that, especially knowing more about what women want and what they want to fantasize and what they want to pretend. We don't really know very much after thousands of years of what women want because women have been told so often what they should want.
Well, I think that's a lot of fear. That's the fear that some women who might have fantasies about submission have, the fear that they'd have this fantasy because of sexism in the culture that told them that they should submit. And because of that, some women might want to purge themselves from having that kind of fantasy because it seems like a remnant of a sexist culture. And I wonder if you ever went through that kind of line of thinking.
No, not at all. I mean, I think our sexual fantasies are too apart from the way we are in life. I mean, again, men...
And that it's not logical.
No, men enjoy these fantasies, and we know that very powerful men, judges, senators, lawyers, people like that, very much like to go to professional dominatrices and be dominated. So obviously they are the opposite in daily life of what they are in their fantasy life, and I think that's often true of women. I mean, I myself am a rather strong woman. I'm not easily dominated by anyone, but I enjoy those fantasies. And I think that's often the case. There's no direct logical connection. I mean, women the world over apparently buy bodice ripper romances that are filled with S&M.
You have a series of pornographic novels that are based loosely on the Sleeping Beauty story. And it seems to me it must have been very intentional in a way to set the stories in a fairy tale kind of background because it really connects it to fantasy. It's very clear that this is fantasy, not reality that
exactly.
We're talking about.
Exactly. I wanted to give permission to enjoy. I wanted to remove it from the horrors of everyday life. I wanted to take it out of the harsh environment in which really bad things happen. I wanted it to be, the theme park of S&M.
Now, I want to ask, because everybody grows up with a Sleeping Beauty story, right? And did this seem like a perfect fairy tale for you to write about submission and domination? I mean, here's this woman, she's been asleep for 100 years, and then she's been lying passively for 100 years. The beautiful prince, the handsome prince, mm-hmm. comes along, kisses her, and of course, in your story, then she's kind of ravaged, ravished right away, and becomes the prince's pleasure slave. Of course, mm-hmm. we never get that far in the fairy tale.
No,
but did it seem like a fairy tale that was kind of asking to be a story about submission?
Yeah, I thought it was perfect. But again, I don't think these things out logically. I just sort of started typing away, and that's what happened.
Well, did you read things like that into stories when you were growing up? Did you just?
No, no, not really. But a lot of my writing today is taking those old motifs and changing them, reinventing them. I mean, I did the same thing in a novel called The Mummy. Instead of the mummy staggering through the novel, strangling people, dripping bandages and dust, my mummy gets unwrapped and he's a charmer. You know, I love to play with that kind of surprise. It's very like the Sleeping Beauty thing, the turnabout suddenly.
It seems to me a lot of people are willing to defend sexually explicit art or sexually explicit movies, but draw the line at pornography. The defense is always, this is sexually explicit, but it is not pornography. Do you think, do you feel like it's time for people to defend pornography?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think really that freedom of expression and freedom of speech and freedom in the arts is so important to us as a culture that there should be no form of censorship, really. I mean, there are always going to be certain forms of regulation within families, for example, of what the family wants to watch or read or have in its house or on its TV set, etc. But I think it's so important for the public not to involve itself with censorship that we have to keep reexamining that question and keep defending the arts. I mean, look at this terrible controversy now about Robert Mapplethorpe. This is absurd. I mean, we in this country have real problems, and they have to do with crime and poverty and real fear in the streets of American cities, and it's got nothing to do with the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe. So for the public to be wasting its time and energy hounding this photographer's work, I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. So I don't talk much about redeeming social merit in my pornography because I don't believe that we should require that argument. I mean, our artists should be, and our writers on all levels, should be able to be mad men and mad women. That's the function of art. Our rock musicians should be able to sing and say what they want. That's what we want them to do. We don't want a homogenous artistic culture where everything resembles a greeting card. We need our mad men and our mad women. We need people to be offensive. We need them to be obscene. That's the way the culture works. I mean, it's only when you have that free artistic marketplace that people have the freedom to create the classics of tomorrow. That's when they can experiment and be wild and be crazy. And the test of free speech is when someone uses it to say or do or write or film or sing something that we don't like. And to me, that's terribly important.
Some of your books have a combination of straight sex, lesbian sex, gay sex in it. Do you feel kind of qualified to write about the different, sex between different sexual preferences and genders and so on?
Do I feel qualified?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Some people only want to read, only feel like it's legitimate for a woman to, for a straight woman to write straight heterosexual sex scenes.
That's absurd. Mm-hmm. With all due respect, that's absolutely absurd. That's like asking Will Shakespeare if he's qualified to write about the royal family of Denmark. I mean, you use your imagination when you write. I mean, one of the greatest books I've ever read is Anna Karenina. And it is an absolutely magnificent novel. And the women in that novel are treated with all the dignity and all the depth that the men are treated with. And it was written by a man. I mean, the imagination is what interests me. And when I'm sitting at that computer and writing my books, I go into these characters and I become them. I think the idea that we should limit ourselves to our own experience in our writing is sterile and ludicrous. I mean, what did the Bronte sisters know of the world? But thank God they wrote Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre. They gave us Heathcliff and Mr. Rochester. I mean, thank God Mary Shelley gave us the monster and Dr. Frankenstein. I mean, but what did she know about a medical student? I mean, what did she know about Dr. Frankenstein? What did she know about being a man-made monster? But she didn't let that stop her. And she gave us a really magnificent book. And this happens over and over again with fiction, and it happens over and over again with women, that they somehow go out of the confines of their lives, and they have great adventures in the pages of the books they write. And I hope that keeps happening.
Your new book, The Witching Hour, was published to coincide with Halloween. I wonder, on days when you're not busy on a book tour and doing signings and everything, do you ever do anything special on a Halloween night?
I usually just trick-or-treat with my son, Christopher.
Do you dress up?
No. I wear one of my black capes. It's cold in New Orleans on Halloween. But no, I don't really. Halloween has just always been sort of a fun thing, but I don't take it terribly seriously.
One last question, and I realize this might be too personal, but has writing novels that have kind of explicit sex and it changed your sex life?
Actually, I don't think so. I really don't. You know, I've been married to the same man for almost 30 years and very, very happily married. I think ours is a great love affair. I can't say that it has, you know, changed it very much.
Well, Anne Rice, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Anne Rice's new book is The Witching Hour. Next time, we talk about the film business with Jake Eberts. He founded the companies that produced Gandhi, Local Hero, The Killing Fields, and Driving Miss Daisy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The stuff of Halloween, tales of the crypt, fear, evil, and possession, that was the stuff of H.P. Lovecraft's writing. Coming up, commentator Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of Lovecraft. The exact origins of football and baseball are obscure, but we know exactly who invented basketball and exactly where the first game ever was played. Coming up, we talk with Robert Peterson, the author of a new book on the early days of basketball. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording by composer and musician Todd Machover. Lloyd says Machover's blending of classical and rock influences, along with a shot of computer technology, makes him one of today's most exciting young composers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The foreign ministers of Syria, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia are meeting in Jeddah tonight. It's an unexpected gathering that comes at a time when Soviet leader Gorbachev has called on Arab states to open new talks in the Persian Gulf crisis. NPR's Deborah Amos has more on the story.
The Egyptian president dismissed the Soviet leader's call today, and the Arab summit would be a summit of insults, he said. Hosni Mubarak's tough statement come before a surprise meeting in Jeddah. The meeting was called to coordinate positions ahead of a trip to the region by the U.S. Secretary of State, James Baker. However, there is clearly trouble in the anti-Iraq alliance. Syria has resumed its press attacks on the United States for supporting Israel, and a Syrian official said today that Syria would not fight against Iraq. Syria has sent more than 4,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are pressing the Syrians to send more. According to Saudi sources, the Syrians say they've not been rewarded enough for siding with the U.S. against Iraq, and tonight's meeting in Jeddah will focus on Syria's complaints. In Riyadh, this is Deborah Amos.
President Bush says that he's running out of patience with Iraqi treatment of American hostages, and the president of Egypt says the crisis in the Gulf has become so dangerous that it could explode at any time. Iraq's information minister held a news conference in Baghdad, where he indicated the U.S. is spreading what he termed false reports on the condition of hostages in order to justify an attack on Iraq. The group that handles Scholastic Aptitude Tests, or SATs, has announced what it calls significant changes. These changes come at the end of a 3-year study and follow criticism that the tests are racially biased and are not accurate for measuring intelligence. Tom Verdi of member station WBUR has more.
The principal changes to the SATs include more reading and less multiple choice answers to some questions. Nearly half the verbal section will now include critical reading, and 20% of the math questions will ask students to produce their own answers rather than choose from a list. Harvard University President Derek Bok, who co-chaired the committee which revised the SATs, said that these reforms more closely reflect the skills students use in classrooms.
That begins to send a useful signal to schools that it is this problem-solving ability that is important rather than simply the ability to identify the correct answer from a predetermined list.
The first set of revised tests will be administered in 1994. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Verdi.
Consumer spending went up a strong 1.1% last month, but rising prices made a big dent in income and savings. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 6 points to close at 2,442.33. On volume of some 157 million shares, trading was moderate.
This is Fresh Air. For those who observe Halloween, Maureen Carrigan reviews the haunting literary legacy of H.P. Lovecraft later on the show. The music of Todd Machover combines a classical background with computer electronics, minimalism, and rock. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks he's one of the most exciting of the younger generation of contemporary composers. Lloyd has a review of Machover's latest album, Flora.
These beautiful overlapping voices at the beginning of Todd Machover's Flora both belong to soprano Carol Bennett. Here's what happens as her voice gets even further multiplied, splintered, and reassembled by computer-generated electronics. Composers of electronic music tend to be more interested in sound than in structure. But Todd Machover is a real musician, as you might expect, since he's a former student of Elliot Carter and Roger Sessions, two of the giants of modern American non-electronic composers. He's been exploring the use of what he calls hyper-instruments. This is an approach he's helped develop at the MIT Media Laboratory and Experimental Media Facility, which he directs. In Machover's own words, these hyper-instruments are designed to augment and expand performance virtuosity in real time using intelligent, interactive machines. As I understand this, someone plays a computer as if it were another instrument and transforms the sound of traditional instruments and human voices as they are being made. Flora was actually intended to be pre-recorded, but most of Machover's pieces are meant to be performed live. Machover conducts his exhilarating piece, Bug Mudra, while wearing an electronic glove on his left hand. This glove forwards the impulses of his gestures to the computers, which immediately change the quality of the sound. The title, Bug Mudra, refers to both classical Indian hand gesturing, or mudra, and computer bugs. The actual ensemble consists of two guitars, electric and acoustic, played here by David Starobin and Oren Fader, and electronic percussion and acoustic suspended cymbals, played by Daniel Kennedy. The recording is of a live performance in Tokyo earlier this year. There are two other works on the Flora album. Towards the Center starts by showing the rhythmic connection between minimalism and rock, then takes them both somewhere to some unearthly oasis neither has ever been before. Machover wrote the second piece, Famine, in collaboration with the South African-born novelist Rose Moss. This is an unsettling, rather creepy cantata for four amplified voices and tape. the British vocal group Electric Phoenix commissioned it as part of a series of works by American composers about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The liner notes include diagrams that chart the relationship between the instruments and the computers. But frankly, I find this about as interesting as a lecture on how many vibrations per second a violin string makes. What's important is that Macover's vivid musical imagination holds the music together. He creates emotional structures that are both beautiful and compelling. The sonorities are haunting, but Macover never allows a sound to remain simply an end in itself.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Todd Macover's new album, Flora, on Bridge Records. This is Fresh Air. Professional basketball today is a high-stakes sport where the top players sign multi-million dollar contracts and are turned into media stars. But this flashy sport had rather humble beginnings. It was slow-moving and often played in a cage with a hand-sewn leather ball. My guest, Robert Peterson, has documented the early history of basketball in his new book, Cages to Jump Shots. Peterson is also the author of Only the Ball Was White, an account of baseball's Negro leagues in the days before Jackie Robinson. Peterson points out that while most sports have evolved from other sports, basketball is the only real national sport that was developed by one man. His name was James Naismith.
At the time, this was in 1891, he was an instructor at the School for Christian Workers in Springfield, Massachusetts. It was a YMCA training school. And he was assigned a class of rather mature students, men who were going to become YMCA general secretaries, and they had to take gym every day. And he found that they were very unhappy with the YMCA's wintertime regimen of calisthenics and weight training and jumping over the horse and the simple children's games. And so he wanted to invent a game from scratch that would interest grown men, and that led to the development of basketball. But it turned out to be a very simple game, and students at the training school fell in love with it and took it back to their local YMCAs during the Christmas vacation that year of 1891, and it became an immediate hit in YMCAs all over the country.
Now, in the very early days of the game, there was the basket had a bottom, so the ball was contained in the basket.
Yes.
And the referee would have to climb up a ladder and retrieve the ball anytime somebody made a basket.
Yes, or punch it out with a long pole. There was a type of basket, though, that had a a cord hanging down from it, and the cord was attached to the net. And when the referee pulled the cord, it lifted the net, and the ball rolled out the top. But until 1912, the rule said that the ball must be thrown into the basket and stay there in order to count as a score.
Basketball early on had a reputation for being a very rowdy sport. The wise were worried that people were playing a game that was leading to violence. The rowdiness discouraged fans from attending. It certainly doesn't seem like a very violent sport now. What led to the constant fights early on in the game?
It's true that basketball was very rough in its early years. Primarily, I think, at least in the professional ranks, because they retained the double dribble. That is, a player could dribble the ball as many times as he wanted, catch it with both hands, and resume dribbling. Now, this meant that a large, strong man could just bounce the ball with both hands down the floor and back into everybody on the way. And consequently, there was an awful lot of body contact.
The game, the way you described it, moved really slowly early on.
Yes.
Is that because there was no rule about dribbling? You could hold on to the ball as long as you wanted to. It sounds like people moved across the court really slowly.
Well, that's generally true. There were no rules at the time, of course, about how long you could hold the ball. There was no 24-second shot clock. There wasn't even a rule that you had to get it across a mid-court line within 10 seconds. And so it was perfectly possible for a team to stay in the backcourt for minutes on end if they wanted to. And that was good strategy. If you held a three-point lead in the last few minutes of a game, it was good strategy to play keep away instead of trying to make a basket. And that's really one of the reasons why, probably the most important reason why it was so slow and why scores were so low in those early years.
What sped up the game?
Mainly, I think, well, probably two things. Number one, the athletes were becoming better, I think, by the 1930s. In 1932, they established the 10-second rule, which forced a team to advance the ball into its forecourt within 10 seconds. They also adopted the rule that a player could not stay within the foul lane for more than 3 seconds. And then in 1937, they eliminated the center jump. Previous to that rule change, there was a center jump after every score and, of course, to start each quarter. So those rule changes in the 30s added a great deal to speeding up the game. Of course, the thing that made it what it is today was the 24-second shot clock, which was adopted in 1954 by the professionals.
Like baseball, basketball started with black leagues and white leagues. Can you tell us something about one of the best teams in the black leagues?
Well, there was really no black league in basketball. There were in baseball. I mean,
it was just like black teams.
There were black teams, mm-hmm. All black teams. The two best known were the Renaissance Big Five and the Harlem Globetrotters, whom most fans of today are very well aware of. The Renaissance were the older team. They were formed in 1923 in New York and became, in the 1930s, the best-known barnstorming team in the country, excellent team. They're now, as a team, in the Hall of Fame. The Globetrotters came along in 1927, but they were confined pretty much to the Midwest and the Upper Northwest until around 1940. And by the way, in their early years, the Globetrotters played straight basketball. They weren't doing comedy at all, and they developed into a very excellent team. The Renaissance won the first World Tournament, which was a tournament for professional teams in the 1940s, and the Globetrotters won the second. So you know very well that there had to be two very good basketball teams there because they were defeating the champions of white leagues in achieving that status of world tournament champions.
The average height of players in basketball has changed a lot over the years. You write about how 6'5" used to be considered real a giant size in the early days. Can you discuss a little bit the height changes that have taken place and why you think that's happened?
Yes, the in the professional game, it's hard to establish accurate statistics on the heights of the early players. But we do know that until around 1930, a six-footer was considered a big man. Well, now a six-footer is a midget, of course, in the NBA. The reason seems to have been that thinking among coaches before, say, 1935 or 38, somewhere in there, was that the really big man, the 6'5", 6'8", 6'10" man, was too clumsy to play basketball. And indeed, the really tall men that did play in the 20s and 30s were considered rather clumsy and rarely ran. They were mainly on the team to get the tip-off that came after every score, and that was their purpose in being on the team. They hardly touched the ball after that, and it wasn't until a few coaches did accept some big men in the 30s and then into the 40s that the big men began to really dominate the game.
How do you think the sport has changed because of the changing height of the players?
Well, it's now, as the sports writers say, it's now played above the rim. That is, the players are so tall and strong and can jump so high that they can. Most of the players in the NBA can dunk the ball with ease, and that was never done in the early days, although one of the reasons was in those days you couldn't touch the rim. If you did, your score would have been nullified. But today, of course, they hang on the rim. They're so strong and big. The game is entirely different than it was even 40 years ago. Certainly today they're bigger and stronger and faster than they were in the early days of the NBA itself. And I can't imagine that they won't get better yet, but some of the things they do make an old-timer like me bug-eyed just watching.
Like what?
Well, they can take two steps from the foul line, and they're on top of the rim. Well, I couldn't even get near that, and I'm 6 feet tall. Their shooting is absolutely astonishing to somebody who played in the 40s and 50s. In those days, if you got 33% shooting average, you were a pretty good shot. And nowadays, if you're not around 65 or 70, you can't make the ball club. So their skills are just eons beyond what they were in the 30s, 40s, 50s, even the 60s.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about basketball.
Thank you.
Robert Peterson's new history of the early years of basketball is called Cages to Jump Shots. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have news from Washington about the embargo against Iraq, some conflicting statements of how well it's working. President Bush seems to be despairing of the embargo being enough to alter Saddam Hussein's behavior, while the State Department has a slightly more upbeat report on how well U.N. sanctions are doing against Iraq. Also, news of an Illinois congressional race where the incumbent has been tagged by the challenger with complicity in the SNL scandal. And also, news of how great a financial advantage incumbents enjoy over their challengers in both House and Senate races.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of writer H.P. Lovecraft, one of the masters of the Gothic horror story. Critic Maureen Carrigan says it's fitting to commemorate Lovecraft's anniversary on Halloween, when the ghosts, vampires, and demons he wrote about seem most real. His tales, she warns, aren't for the squeamish.
To celebrate Halloween, lots of people rent horror movies like The Exorcist or House on Haunted Hill. They're okay, but I think the scariest movies are the ones that play deep in our imaginations when we read a bone-chilling tale of terror. Poe, of course, is the master, but his stories are so familiar, they're almost cozy. For truly horrifying stories, I turn to Poe's soulmate in evil and his greatest literary inheritor, H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft's life is as faintly creepy as his name. He was born in 1890, the last descendant of a once prominent New England family. He was married for a brief time, but lived most of his life in semi-seclusion with two elderly aunts in Rhode Island. Death claimed him rather prematurely in 1937. The stories Lovecraft began to publish in 1917 appeared exclusively in pulp magazines like Weird Tales. Only his fierce cult following prevented those stories from vanishing into dust after his death. In terms of terror, Lovecraft's tales often rival Poe's, and they're furnished with the same ghastly details. Decaying but not quite empty tombs, unholy pits, black cats, and insane narrators. Like Nathaniel Hawthorne, Lovecraft was especially sensitive to the terrors lurking in old colonial houses. Listen to some of the opening lines from his story, The Picture in the House. The true epicure in the terrible esteems most of all the ancient, lonely farmhouses of backwoods New England. 200 years and more they have leaned and squatted there, while the vines have crawled and the trees have swelled and spread. They are almost hidden now, but the small-paned windows still stare shockingly, as if blinking through a lethal stupor which wards off madness by dulling the memory of unutterable things. Lovecraft's critics wince at this purple prose, but I think his rich, musty style of writing suits his macabre themes. He liked to write about cannibalism, and some of his stories, like The Rats in the Walls, are downright grisly. He also wrote about soul possession, telepathic hypnotism, and sinister visitors from outer space. Lovecraft's masterpiece is his novella, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. It's a tale of warlocks in 18th century New England who are raising up the souls of great men in order to capture their wisdom and power. Many of Lovecraft's stories have been republished lately by Ballantine Books. Unfortunately, the covers of these editions are adorned with blood-rimmed eyes, decomposing skulls, mummies, the kinds of things you don't want staring up at you from your bedside table when you wake up in the dead of the night. But even worse are the images that haunt your mind once you've read Lovecraft. In his short story, The Thing on the Doorstep, Lovecraft wrote, "There are horrors beyond life's edge that we do not suspect, and once in a while, man's evil prying calls them just within our range." Reading Lovecraft may make you feel like those horrors are too close for comfort. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross.
We're going out tonight to break some things. We'll dine on lemonade and pigeon's wings. We'll set your shoes on fire and then your hair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how to finance a movie. We talk with Jake Eberts, founder of the companies that produced Gandhi, The Killing Fields, and Driving Miss Daisy. Also, we meet two of the kids in the hall, Scott Thompson and Mark McKinney, a part of the Canadian comedy group now being seen on HBO. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.